I want to share with you guys a story that kind of relates to all that's been happening right now. So I go to the barbershop today. Go to the barbershop to cut my hair. I cut my hair every week. You can judge me. So I tell my barber, he asked me, like, who's on the show tonight? And so I tell him it's one of the mayoral candidates, Keith Amamiya. His answer to that was, who's the current mayor? This guy's in his 30s. He then proceeds to ask another one of his barbers who the current mayor is. They did not know. It is because of that is why we are having this forum here tonight. Now, I want to say 2020 has been an interesting year, to say the least. 2020 has been a year where we can all say the word, it's been a wash. We can say all the words of negativity that we can, and I don't disagree. But another thing that we have to say for the year 2020 is the word of evolution, the word of change. Never before have we seen a situation happen in mid-March like we saw. Never before have we seen, months later, the huge solidarity that was the Black Lives Matter movement. All of these things are evolving us as people, so it is only fair to lead that progression on with the upcoming mayoral election. This is by far, in my opinion, the biggest mayoral election I've ever seen as I've been born and raised on this island. Never before as any mayor, and I lived through the Frank Fossey era all the way through, that has dealt with something like this, that has dealt with a year like this. We are at July 1st. This is the exact halfway point of the year. This is why this matters to me very much, much like the Black Lives Matter situation happened. Much like this entire year has been unlike anything else that any of us has experienced. That is why this mayoral election is crucial, and this is critical, and this is why I believe that everyone needs to pay attention to this and understand what's going on. I don't want to hear anybody saying that they don't know who the current mayor is. That is the problem with Hawaii politics, with Hawaii as voters. Voting has been going down each and every year. And I want to say a big shout out to and props to Mr. Keith Amamiya. I'm going to talk to him about this in just a few moments here, but there was a debate on PBS that I wrote a review on, or I did a video on, pretty much critiquing the way the debate went. The debacle, I guess you can call it. But he was the first to message me to ask for this interview. So shout out to you, Keith, before you come on here. And for the people that don't know Keith, quick intro on Keith Amamiya. Born and raised in Oahu, business executive, nonprofit leader, lawyer for over 30 years. Notably served, though, as executive director of the Hawaii High School Athletic Association. He is running for political office for the very first time. And this is for a critical one. This is for the mayor's race. Doesn't get any bigger than that for the city and county of Honolulu. In fact, this is the most important mayor's race of all time. So let's, without further ado, let's bring him on in. He is here. Let's bring him on in as we share the screen here.
As we await Mr. Keith Amamiya, who will be joining us, hopefully. Uh-oh. Isn't Wi-Fi great? Isn't it always great? I'll ask Keith about Teddy Riley as we're waiting. Here he is. Keith, you made it.
Yeah, I made it. Thank you, Aaron. I'm doing good. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much for joining me, man. And I was saying, I don't know if you heard beforehand, that you were the first person to message me after the great Brady Bunch Zoom chat debate that you guys had on PBS, which I'm sure you enjoyed very much. So no Zoom chats tonight, but thank you very much for joining us. And for joining us, this is the crowd that I know you want to reach out to. And all of us need to get involved. So thank you. Thank you very much. Were you at something previous to this? I know we had to move this up to 7 p.m. Tell us where were you at?
So I was at sign waving in Eva Beach with a lot of my Eva Beach supporters. And so we were on Fort Weaver Road near Queens West. And we had a good crowd and good reaction, good feedback. There's a lot more traffic now. So that's good, I suppose, in the sense, you know, people are getting out and about. Well, yeah, it's not good if you're stuck in it, but it's good that our economy is getting back up to speed. That's the way I look at it.
That's a very good sign. Yes. Yeah. That is definitely the case. Yeah. So I gotta say for the people that don't know, give us a quick share with us your background.
Sure. Well, born and raised on Oahu, and you know, lived in East Honolulu, and. I guess, well, what the story I tell a lot of people about my upbringing is when I was in high school, you know, my family had its share of issues and whatnot. So I was getting shuttled from family member to family member or relative. And then in high school, my best friend's family took me in. They adopted or hanaid me, as we like to say in Hawaii. Yeah. And that was a transformative time in my life because, you know, they brought me in. They didn't have to, you know, they treated me like a blood relative and they showed me a lot of love, compassion, you know, importance of giving back and being selfless and, you know, not expecting anything in return. And so that kind of formed the basis for why I'm running for mayor today, in large part because they gave me a second chance, so to speak. And I want to do what I can to give other people a second chance because I'm living proof that all you need is like a hand to lift you up, and you know, you can be propelled forward and take a different trajectory in life. And I learned that a lot in high school sports too, that a lot of times a coach or a teacher can make a huge impact on a child's life. And so that kind of was my deal. And then I moved on from high school to University of Hawaii. I got a degree in finance. And then I got a law degree afterwards. So I was a litigation attorney for a while. And then at the age of 32, I was named to head the Hawaii High School Athletic Association. And that was the second pivotal moment in my life. And what I like to tell people is I was young and lucky to have the opportunity. But I thought, oh, it's pretty neat. I'm going to get paid to run sports, you know, and be in charge of sports. And that's true. But what I also learned and really had an impact on me is I got to travel across the state and meet working class families all over the state. And especially on Oahu, I met many, many working class families. And I learned firsthand how many families were struggling to make ends meet. And like I tell people, they were forced to make hard choices, whether to pay rent or put food on the table, whether to make a car payment or pay their medical bill, or more and more, and COVID will unfortunately probably worsen the situation, whether to stay here and struggle or uproot their family and move to the mainland to try to make ends meet, even though they don't want to, because, you know, they love Hawaii, but they just can't make ends meet. So that also moved me to run for mayor, that I don't feel enough politicians are fighting for working class people. They're not doing what they can to make our lives easier. And so, you know, that's why I'm throwing my hat in the ring, a first time candidate, as you mentioned. Oh yeah. You lost me?
Yeah.
You got me? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah, it happens on this. Yeah. You're back.
So anyway,
welcome to IG Live. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So anyway, that's the other reason I'm running is because I care about our community. I want to bring change, a fresh perspective, new leadership, and restore trust in government.
Right. And I gotta say, being this the first time in running, why mayor over governor? What was the decision there?
Well, a couple of things. You know, governor is in 2 years. I just felt in the current stage in my life, whether from my career standpoint and my family standpoint. So I have a wife, we've been married 24 years now. We just made 24 years and
congratulations.
We have a son. Thank you. Who's a sophomore in college. And, I was hesitant to run in large part because he was still in high school or younger. I thought about running before, but I just didn't want him to have to deal with the stuff that comes with politics and the nastiness and other unpleasant stuff. And he's away in school on the mainland, or he was until COVID brought him back home to finish up the spring semester. So, and again, this 2020, I felt this was the right time. But also, I mean, most importantly, I'm born and raised on Oahu. I've lived here most of my life, and I love Oahu. I want to make it better, and I want to create a better Oahu for the following generations. And so, as mayor, obviously, you have a big impact on you know the success of Oahu moving forward, and. You're involved in a lot more day-to-day stuff as opposed to the governor. I mean, the things that impact you, whether it's, you know, homelessness, housing, rail, potholes, you know, you name it. I felt I could have a bitter impact as mayor as opposed to governor in 2 years. And in 2 years from now, that's an eternity in politics. And so I just felt it was the right time and certainly the right office for me.
Right, we got to keep you in there long, Keith, because we got a lot of stuff we got to figure out. So yeah, 2 years ain't gonna cut it. Ige knows. So I gotta say though, regarding your campaign, if we can go into that, you were the first one I saw personally on social media. You're the first one out there out the gate, and from the beginning of the year, I looked all the way into the lockdown in March. What was going through your mind as far as your campaign strategy to continue the ads? As everything's getting worse and worse with everything, what was your thought process? Looking back at that, would you want to continue, stay the course, or were you thinking of pulling back?
So once it became clear that the pandemic was a serious thing, I mean, arguably the biggest crisis Hawaii and our country's faced in 100 years since the last Great Depression and the last pandemic, we decided to pivot and not campaign as much. First, it just wasn't appropriate. People are struggling. They're out of work. We saw, you know, my wife and I distributed food in many of those food distribution centers, like at Aloha Stadium and elsewhere. Cars were lined up for 4 hours ahead of time. So we felt it wasn't appropriate to keep campaigning per se, but we wanted to pivot the campaign to help the community. So we participated in a lot of food distribution drives. We got involved, or I spearheaded a meal program to provide meals to public school students in Palolo and the Liliha area. We also provided meals to healthcare workers and domestic violence survivors and their children. And in the 2 month span, we distributed over 14,000 meals. We distributed hundreds of pounds of produce. We also provided meals to senior citizens who are down the street from our headquarters in Kaka'ako, living in low-income rental facility. So that's what we did. But and we also couldn't campaign. I mean, you have to be socially distant anyway. Right. I mean, you couldn't have big events. Even going door to door was not appropriate because of the fear of spreading COVID. Right. So to your point, I mean, I always felt social media was going to be important with or without the pandemic. And I also wanted to reach out to, frankly, a younger audience. I mean, that's, I'm running for everybody, but I'm running especially for the younger audience. And when I say younger, I'm not just saying teenagers and 20-year-olds. I mean, people in their 40s and younger generally they don't get involved. They haven't been involved in politics. And I want to get them involved. I want them to vote. I want them to register to vote and then vote. A lot of younger people aren't registered. So, as you know, that's why you're doing your show on Instagram Live. That's the best way to reach younger audiences. And so that's why we made a concerted effort to go hard on social media. I mean, put a big emphasis on it, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc. And it's been successful. That's a way we've reached out to a lot of younger people who are voting for the first time, who are volunteering for our campaign. And there's a lot of positive energy, even at the sign waving at Eva Beach earlier today. I mean, the majority of sign waivers were high school kids, college kids, and it just it's exciting, and many of them who are of voting age said they're going to vote for the first time, so it's great.
Wow, That's great to hear. Great to hear. Yeah. Getting back to the whole COVID situation, I know you probably had this question asked many times. How would you have handled the whole COVID situation from March differently than, say, Ige or Kurt?
Well, a couple of things. First, I probably would have started the quarantine earlier. We're lucky we didn't get a wave of COVID or people who are, you know, contracted the virus. Our numbers have been up the last couple of weeks, but we're still relatively low compared to the rest of the country, and we hope to keep it that way. I might have started that earlier, but again, we dodged the bullet, so to speak. But secondly, I would have somehow, some way, tried to make communication better between all the different levels of government, from federal to state to city, because we were getting a lot of mixed messages about what you can and cannot do, what's open, what's not open, when it'll be open. And so I think a little better coordination would have been in order. And I learned a lot about collaborating, communicating, especially running high school sports or working as a business executive in the private sector, that you need communication is key, especially when you're dealing in certain cases, like with 95 high schools across the state, public and private. You can never over communicate. You need to keep communicating. So I would have emphasized that more in terms of communication, not only within the government branches, but also with the public. And then third, we're finally reopening the economy. I'm glad we are. Of course, we need to keep our community safe and not allow the spread to happen. But there's a lot of people unemployed, and we need to do what we can to bring tourism back again safely, and maybe not at the rate of 10 million people a year. But so many jobs are dependent on the tourism industry. So I'm glad that that's going to open up, I believe, on August 1st. But even that one, maybe if we could have opened it up sooner, it would have been better, because, you know, for the hotel workers, for example, to be out of work for 4 months or more is an extreme hardship, obviously.
Right. And I guess this could be something that we could kind of, I guess, look into the future. Hypothetically, what policies or procedures do you have for Oahu in the wake of, I guess, the second wave, whenever we decide to have that happen, regarding the economy, regarding unemployment, when this hits, what would you implement, Esmer?
So I know, especially on the mainland, they're predicting a second wave. I'm hoping we don't have a second wave.
Of course.
We do what we can, you know, to... See, and we can do a lot. You know, we're an island state, so we're more contained than other states. And if we have strict guidelines on incoming visitors to the island, whether it's getting tested before you hop on the plane or you quarantine when you get here, and even some post-arrival testing and contact tracing, I really believe we can avoid the second wave, unlike the mainland where you can't control your borders, so to speak. So my goal would be to prevent a second wave, because we really can't afford to shut down again for several months. It'll be devastating for our economy. So I'm confident we can do that. The other reason I'm confident is in Hawaii, for the most part, we are respectful of each other. We're considerate. And we understand the need for...
Oh, it's happening again, Keith.
Per se.
Someone,
I need to get, someone was calling my phone, and so I had to shut
Hang him up.
The call.
Hang him up.
Yeah, I did. Right, I declined the call.
All right. But, Spectrum of Hawaiian Tail. All right.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we need to do what we can as a community to continue to wear masks in public, just wash your hands all the time, and adhere to social distancing guidelines.
Right. And you bring up a good point of how Hawaii, Honolulu, everywhere beat this thing is we like to follow the rules here. And apparently so. And that's how we took care of it. And if we just continue to do so, you're exactly right. Wanted to shift gears back to your ads. You focused a lot of them strongly on mental health, and where you featured your mother. I guess please give us, for the people that don't know, the background on that.
So my mom throughout most of her adult life, suffered from mental illness, and it was obviously, you know, a difficult time for our family. And what frustrated me was that the laws are very protective of mentally ill people, which, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's very difficult to get them help if and when they need it. And the standard is very high to require a person to get the help they need, or to, I mean, I don't want to say force, that's too strong a word, but sometimes they, you know, they're not of sound mind to know they need help.
Right.
And so that was a challenge and a difficulty. So, and I know a lot of families deal with it, and, you know, it's not something to obviously volunteer and shout to the world, but I felt it was an important enough issue that we don't pay attention enough to mental right. health and mental illness. I yeah. mean, like doctors and others tell you, mental illness, it has a stigma, you know, which I understand, but we need to confront it and talk yeah. about it in order Definitely. To fix it. And a lot more families, and sure, my ad has definitely proved what I thought, that a lot of other families deal with that situation and for whatever reason can't get their loved one the help they need. So I want to shed light on that. I want to also do what I can as mayor to increase mental health services for those who need it. And hopefully we can, you know, solve or at least curb this growing problem in our society. Like many doctors say, you know, you have a bad back or a sore neck, you know, you see the doctor. Well, mental illness is similar in that, you know, it's not yeah. your fault. It's nothing yeah. to be ashamed of. And we need to get our loved ones the help they need.
Do you see increased funding in that department being something to look at? What do you see as far as the financials involved?
Of course, it's going to cost money and a commitment from government, but I feel that it's something that needs to be done, whether it's getting money from the federal, state, and city levels, even the nonprofit world could pitch in. But the way I see it, there's a lot of mentally ill people out there that need yeah. services, and that the more we neglect them and don't treat it, especially the homeless, it costs, the way I look, it costs even more to not treat mental illness than it is to you know, treat it and nip it right. in the bud. And then the, you know, the other thing we forget is that these people, if they get the right medication, in many cases there's a lot of medicines that and treatments that can curb or minimize the mental illness someone's suffering from. They can live a better life, and that's right. what it's all about, you know, a much right. better quality of life than they're currently living.
Right. And it's increased along with homelessness, just the quarantine in general, with unemployment, anxiety issues, mm-hmm. domestic violence issues, business closures. I guess this is going to be an issue more so than any other mayor previously. And that's something we definitely gotta look at. And it's good that you're putting that on the forefront. So I guess let's go to homelessness. I guess this that comes up in any discussion or political debate, but I would like to ask you a different route. Where, what about the origin of homelessness in Honolulu, in Oahu? What is the origin of the homelessness problem that created this? What do you think was the thing that started, or things that started it?
So, bottom line, it's the extremely high cost of housing in Hawaii and on Oahu in particular. If you look at the homelessness problem on the mainland, it's skyrocketed in other cities. And it's been mainly in cities where the housing costs have skyrocketed in a relatively short period of time, whether it's the Bay Area or Los Angeles or Seattle. Honolulu is no different. That's caused a lot of people to be displaced. They can't afford a place to live. So one of my priorities as mayor will be to attack the massive shortage of housing on Oahu. I was the first and only candidate to create a Housing for All plan, which is a detailed plan to address our housing shortage. We currently have 22,000 units or we're short 22,000 units on Oahu in terms of the demand. And if we can build more houses, we can get more people housed. Now, certainly, there's people on the streets who need mental health treatment and or drug abuse treatment. They need to be addressed as well. But the vast majority of homeless are homeless because they can't afford rent. There's a lot of hidden homeless out there. I think a lot of communities will verify what I'm saying. Families who live in their cars, families who you don't see, they're, you know, they don't want to be known as homeless. And, and again, I think, you know, we have this perception of that most homeless people are have severe mental illness or severe drug abuse issues, which is true. There's a fair amount, but the majority would love to live under a roof in a safe environment with a bed and a clean bathroom, which in within which to habitate.
Right. With this problem being worse and worse throughout the years, why do you feel that the previous and current leadership has been, in a way, a lot neglecting this situation?
Good question. It comes down to political will. And it's yet another reason why I'm running. I'm frustrated with everyone else. I mean, this problem has existed it's for years, and it seems to be getting worse. I think it's stabilized, but that's better than getting worse. But it's still bad. I think everyone will agree, even politicians. And so that's another reason I chose to run. I feel that it'll be helpful to get an outsider, someone with a different perspective, someone without an agenda, someone who is willing to try new and different ways to solve the homelessness problem. And so I attribute it to lack of political will and maybe people who are set in their own ways or people in office who've kind of just given up. But I refuse to give up. I don't want the Oahu we all love to become something that we're not accustomed to, that is a place that our children and our children's children don't get to enjoy like we do.
Right.
Or did have a chance when we were growing up.
No, exactly right. I guess we could look at the laws regarding homelessness, enforcement of laws such as the sin lie ban for unsheltered homeless. What is your take on that? Do you support that enforcement of that law, or why or why not?
So I have a lot of thoughts on that. One of them is that, well, I mean, no one should sit or lie on a sidewalk. And that's not good for, well, no one should be placed in a position they feel they have no choice but to live on a sidewalk. You know, that's not good. It's also not good. It's not fair for everyday citizens, so to speak, to have to walk around a homeless person on the sidewalk or be in fear of their safety. But at the same time, the city and the state and all of us really need to provide housing and shelter for these people and get them the help they need. So I'm of the opinion they don't want to be on the sidewalk. They're not choosing to be. They just feel they don't have another option. And so we as a society and as government, we need to provide a place for them, and we failed up to this point.
Right. I guess we go on to the other side of the coin of homelessness. This is our first viewer question, and this is coming from an owner of a small business restaurant in downtown. And his question: Chinatown and downtown have always had issues with homelessness and individuals who are mentally ill. Union Mall and 4th Street Mall have become open air drug markets. Not uncommon to see individuals injecting drugs openly in broad daylight, along with the threat of random acts of violence being done to our community. How would you be able to clean up the open-air drug markets as well as keep large populations of homeless from congregating in our city center?
So I know those areas very well, Union Mall and 4th Street Mall. I worked until I declared for my candidacy in a building that was in between both malls, and yes, it was an unsafe environment. It was an unsanitary environment. What really hit home for me is what my assistant at the time, I would always see her jogging after work from the building to the bus stop, and I asked her one day, "Oh, how come? Why do you jog to the bus stop, or seem like you're in a rush?" And she said, "Because I'm scared walking down either of those malls." And that, and it was broad daylight, you know, still a lot of people working, a lot of people around, and so it just made clear how serious the problem was. And so my solution, so to speak, or suggestion is that I know there was talk of creating homeless centers, which in the Chinatown area.
Right.
We need to pivot and move them away from Chinatown and downtown and provide more services in the Ibile area, you know, and make it, make, give them a reason not to congregate in those areas. And so I'm all for providing more services and treatment centers in the Ibile area, because IHS, Institute of Human Services, is already in that area. You know, there's no good place to put, you know, a large amount of homeless people, but Chinatown is not a, an appropriate place. Again, I go back to just like the sidewalk ban. It's doesn't do them any good to just linger in Chinatown with no services, no food. Let's move them into an area where there are existing services already.
Right. Right, exactly. Another viewer question here. Here we go. Department of Planning and Permitting is notoriously slow in approving plans. Many small business owners view their fast-track application process as legal extortion. If elected, how will you change the status quo and create a friendlier, more efficient DPP office? Another viewer question.
So that's a good question, and I hear concerns about the Department of Planning and Permitting from everybody, whether it's developers, construction companies, even homeowners who want to do a simple renovation. They have to wait a year, sometimes 2 years, for their permit to be approved, and that's just crazy. And for the bigger projects, that hurts our economy. So when a permit is delayed for 6 months, 9 months, a year, that's people who, construction workers who could have been employed much earlier. It's projects that could have been finished much earlier. And so we need to do something to improve that office. Just like homelessness, it's political will. We need to get politicians in there who are going to roll up their sleeves and just get the job done. Bring people together like I've done throughout my career, not care about who gets the credit, make the hard decisions and fix it. In, and so the viewer who asked that question makes a good point that there's these services where you can hire a private company to help process your permit, and you pay them, and they supposedly get your permit faster. And if that's not a symbol or, you know, a glaring warning sign that there's something wrong with the process when you have to pay someone to process your permit faster and get ahead of everyone in a way, that's just wrong. And so what I propose to fix DPP is, number one, they seem short. I've been told they're short staffed, they're understaffed. Provide more workers. Do what it takes. It may cost more money to hire more workers or pay them more to retain them. But if you process the permits faster, you make our economy more robust. And in the long run, you can probably pay for these extra workers because the economy is getting better. The city is getting more in terms of tax revenue, et cetera. Right. We also need to upgrade the technology at the city, including DPP. Even the people at DPP will tell you their equipment and their technology is outdated. We need to make it so that they can process the permits faster, more efficiently. The state unemployment system, they neglected it. I mean, look what happened. Now, granted, in their defense, who could have predicted 200-something thousand claims in a month's time? But they acknowledged that they should have upgraded the system you know, much earlier. And so we can't wait for a catastrophe at DPP to happen before we upgrade the technology. The other thing I would do is also, if we can farm out work to the private sector and have them help DPP, and if someone you know, is willing to pay the fee, I mean, or the city is willing to pay the third party provider. I mean, let's outsource if we need to get the permits processed faster. And I also think when you process the permits faster to safeguard against the concern that buildings won't be built properly, focus on the enforcement and compliance on the back end. But yeah, we need to process the permits faster. It's clearly taking too long. Everyone agrees with that.
That's a notorious thing.
Well,
speaking of fixing things, let's talk about the rail. And Chase, where should the rail last stop be? Are we going Middle Street or are we going to Alamoana?
We need to finish rail at Alamoana as intended for several reasons. Number one, part of the agreement with the federal government to get federal subsidies for rail was that we would finish rail at Alamoana. So we need to, or we run the risk of not getting the full $1.55 billion in federal subsidies. And we also run the risk of having to return the $800 million we already got from the federal government. And we can't afford to give back $800 million. Secondly, ridership will greatly decrease if we don't go all the way to Alamoana and if we stop at Middle Street or shorter. We need to get rail going as deep into town as possible. I mean, if we had our druthers and if we could have done it again, we should have planned and built rail through all the way past Waikiki and all the way to the University of Hawaii. Those are two areas where people would ride rail to, whether it's hotel workers who live on the west side,
one of those.
As you know, Aaron, when UH is in session, well, COVID kind of jammed up our notions of traffic and whatnot, but pre-COVID, UH was in session, traffic was bad. When UH wasn't in session, whether summer break or winter break, there was much less traffic. So obviously, a lot of people go to UH. And if we can build rail all the way there, we'd lessen traffic. So that's some of the reasons why we need to build rail all the way to Alamoana. But another big reason that people forget is that rail will create more economic stimulus by creating transit-oriented development projects. And if you've been lucky to be in other cities or heard or read about Japan, Singapore, Vancouver, who have robust, efficient rail systems or transportation systems, every rail station is a city, mini city within the city. You have housing. We can make a big dent in our housing shortage by building condos at the rail station. You can build restaurants and retail, office space, entertainment areas. You want to create at every rail station a mini city where people who live at the station in a condo don't need a car, can walk to the grocery store or walk to a restaurant to pick up food on the way to their condo from the rail station after work. People tend to forget that transit-oriented development is a huge economic opportunity for the city and also to improve the quality of life for residents as well. You'll release the uses of cars. You'll promote more multi-modes of transportation, multiple, whether it's walking or catching rail, catching the bus or riding your bike. We need to finish rail all the way to Alamoana for now and think about Waikiki and UH. But first things first, let's get to Alamoana first.
Right. Please get that done. Got a question that just came in through the scrolling here that one of the projects that kind of was put in the back burner with all of the quarantine, the Aloha Stadium project. Now, what is your take on that? How do we pursue that with the economy the way that it is now? And of course, what you just mentioned regarding rail, where does that lie?
Right. So I'm on the Aloha Stadium board. So I'm privy to a lot of information about the project. As of now, the project is still going forward. And there is still the money was appropriated last year for the project. So that's another project like rail that we need to go and finish because for several reasons. Number one, Aloha Stadium in its current state will not last much longer. No. It's in danger of having to be extensively renovated, which will cost tens of millions of dollars. And it's in danger of being a safety hazard if we don't address it soon or build a new stadium. Secondly, like rail, Aloha Stadium, a new Aloha Stadium will stimulate a lot of development around the stadium. I mean, many of your listeners and viewers have been to other cities and gone to a professional sporting event where the sporting venue is the attraction for the development of other things like restaurants, bars, retail. Right. We have a huge opportunity to build a living, working, play area around Aloha Stadium, like we've seen on the mainland at a lot of other venues. And so that's another huge economic opportunity. It's another opportunity to build more housing for people. Yeah. So we need to proceed with the Aloha Stadium project. And in fact, we are in the process of selecting a developer for the stadium and also the adjacent areas around the stadium to build out housing and retail and whatever else
you have. Okay, great. Because I refuse to go there, Keith. I'm afraid it's going to fall down if I go there. So I really would like Aloha Stadium to be a better Aloha Stadium. It's a... I don't want to get tetanus, Keith. So here's another question that came in. They're off and running here. The recent deaths of people at the hands of police are igniting the country, including city and state. That was another thing that took the country and engulfed it. What should be done in improving policing and police accountability in Honolulu? Should oversight of the police department be strengthened or reformed?
So, well, I'm on the Aloha Stadium Board. I was on the police commission 10 years ago.
Yes,
and so I'm familiar with the police department and the role and function of the police commission. My take on our police department is we don't have the same issues that we do in Minneapolis and other cities, but we can always be better. We can always, improve our police department. The vast majority of our officers are great officers who follow the law and protect us and don't abuse their powers. But like any organization, we can do better. And so what's happened on the mainland is a good opportunity to review our department, whether it should be restructured, whether the police commission should have more oversight over the department. But there's three areas that we should look at in light of what's happened on the mainland. Number one, review the chokehold policy at HPD. Clearly, that's been an issue on the mainland and obviously resulted in some tragic deaths that probably did not need to occur. Secondly, we need to look at considering reporting officers who were suspended or found guilty, so to speak, of wrongdoing. We need to be transparent and build trust in our police department and hold them accountable. And, that kind of rule won't affect the vast majority of officers who don't commit wrongdoing. And so there shouldn't be a concern that this will stain the reputation of good officers, so to speak. I'm not overly concerned, but the ones who cross the line and commit wrongdoing, we should know about it and they should be disclosed. We should also look at what's been called implicit bias training and make sure our officers are not engaged in bias against certain members of our community. But I would say that training should extend to the whole city government. The Black Lives Matter movement has initially focused on police brutality or police abuse issues, but it's grown into something much more. It's brought out the discussion about race relations. And, again, just like police brutality, we don't have the same issues on the mainland yet, and I want to make sure we don't. But, racial discrimination, racial bias is an issue in Hawaii as well. Perhaps it's not as prevalent, but let's keep it that way. Let's improve and make sure we don't get to that point where there are demonstrations, riots, and other and acts of violence as a result of what the community feels is mistreatment or unfairness of any certain group.
Right. I guess we'll switch gears here. Let's go into the with sea levels rising. Reefs being threatened, the king tides term that came and introduced to us by the media. What should Honolulu do to better prepare for the effects of climate change?
So what I tell people is COVID-19 is the crisis of the moment, but climate change is the crisis of our lifetime. And we need to take steps to address that now. We live in an island state, and we're already seeing the effects of rising sea level. And there's predictions from scientists and other experts that by the year 2100, the sea level in Hawaii will rise 3.5 feet. And that is a staggering amount. And yes, most of us won't be around to see it. But in the big scheme of things, 2100 is around the corner, so to speak, in terms of the history and existence of humankind. And it may not affect us, but it's going to affect probably our grandkids and great-grandkids.
Yeah, and exactly.
We need to take those steps to mitigate against climate change now. The city is currently working on a climate action plan, and so we need to finish that plan and implement it and enforce it. And I also think that the city and the state needs to be more aggressive on reaching our goal of 100% renewable energy far sooner than 2045. That's the goal now, but we have really no excuse to do it sooner. We have almost every renewable energy source in Hawaii, whether it's solar, hydro, wind, even geothermal. That's the most controversial one. But we do have multiple options at our disposal. So we should get clean energy much sooner than later. And I also feel that renewable energy can be a big part of our economy, that we should be the world leader in renewable energy and export our expertise. We can create higher paying green jobs, as they call it. So we really have no excuse but to address and attack climate change right now.
Right. That was going to be, I guess, my next question as far as what type of new, we always know Hawaii and Honolulu as the tourism driving economy here. What do you see? Do you see any type of new resource or anything out there that would be something to drive the economy that's not tourism? And
yes,
I guess that's the answer to that.
Yes. So I just mentioned renewable energy. That could be another industry as an alternative to tourism. I mean, don't get me wrong. Tourism will be an important part of our economy for the foreseeable future.
Right.
But we saw or are seeing firsthand the impact of being over-reliant on tourism. Once tourism stopped, it's basically non-existent in Hawaii right now. I mean, very few. We've gone from 30,000 visitors a day to a couple hundred. So basically, tourism is at a standstill, and we've seen the impact on the economy. Now, do we go back to 10 million tourists a year? Probably not, because I think we were suffering from over-tourism. We need to rebuild tourism more carefully, more smartly, perhaps focus on quality over quantity, and maybe focus on higher-end tourists and tourism, but we also need to build up other industries like renewable energy and also agriculture. Agriculture can be an important part of our economy. It should be for a lot of reasons. First of all, we have great climate conditions right now to build to grow quality products. We can grow up for our use. We can export them, and we can also mitigate against food security issues. And by that, I mean, right now, approximately 90% of our food is imported from out of state. And early on in this pandemic, there was a concern when all of us rushed to grocery stores and cleaned out all the shelves. That was kind of scary for a little while.
Yeah.
And, if we did clean out all the shelves and would have to wait till the next Matson ship, container ship came, or Pisha, or whoever else, Right. You know, that could be a week, 2 weeks. And so it's clear we need to grow more food on Oahu, on all of our islands, so we're less reliant on out-of-state food. It also helps the economy. We will have a robust agricultural industry where it will create more jobs. It'll keep open space more to continue to be open and green. A couple of months ago, I went to a farm, Otsuji Farms in Hawaii Kai behind Kaiser High School, just to see how that farm was doing and what they were growing. And because I'm determined to grow agriculture as an alternative to tourism, and it was impressive, the quality of produce. That's the other thing that amazed me. It's much fresher, obviously, when you buy local produce than from the mainland. It takes a while to get here. And by the time it's here, it's not as fresh. Or they pick it before it's ripe. But if you buy local produce here, you can't beat the quality and taste and the price even.
You bring up a great point, yes, as far as buying local. Just got a viewer question here. What will you do to help Native Hawaiians continue to move towards prosperity with regards to health and wealth?
So the way I look at it, if we uplift the economy, we uplift the quality of life, we build more housing, we uplift everybody, including Native Hawaiians. You know, they've at times been one of the forgotten groups, and we need to pay more attention to their plight, to their issues. So when I ran high school sports, I saw that certain areas that were heavily concentrated with Native Hawaiians, whether it's the Leeward Coast or even on Hawaii Island in the Kau, Keau, Pahoa area that also had a high percentage of Native Hawaiians, they tend to get less resources. They tend to struggle financially more. So I did what I could to increase opportunities in those areas. We still need to do that. But again, we as government leaders need to uplift everyone. And if we do, everyone will prosper, including Native Hawaiians.
Right. And great point. And so I got to get this out here because getting a lot of questions in here. And I want to make sure I cover everything, though. I got to say, this just came out. You have a new round of commercials that came out for the month of July. I guess it released last week. You reveal at the end of them that you are a Democrat. What prompted this change and why the reveal now? Because at this time, we were thinking of you as the nonpartisan. Well, the mayor job is a nonpartisan job to begin with. But why the announcement of Democrat at the end of your commercials?
Well, as you point out, it's a nonpartisan race. But I think every candidate gets asked what party you belong to. So I thought, you know, I am a registered Democrat. And so I might as well just tell people. But I also tell people that, you know, I mean, I'm hoping to win. I intend to win. And, you know, I'm not going to be a divisive leader, a partisan leader. I mean, I always want to do what's best for the greater good. And so I'm not looking to not listen to non-democratic citizens, whether they be Republicans or independents or otherwise. But I just got asked that question so much. And if they looked at it, they would see I'm a registered Democrat. So I thought, well, I might as well come out and say it. And that's not to say that, you know, I've been lucky in this campaign. People do want change. And so I have my share of non-democratic support, and I'm very appreciative of it.
Right. And I think I speak for many on this chat that because of it being a nonpartisan, we've always wondered, for the people that sometimes don't reveal, which side do they lean on? So it's something that's not going to be a game changer, I think, it was as far as changing a person's mind, because we all wonder and we just like to know more about that candidate. So,
right. And I want to add, Aaron, you know, again, I'm not so black and white. I have Republican friends. There's Republicans, as I mentioned earlier, who support me. And, you know, again, we disagree on certain issues, but we're not mortal enemies. And that's, again, another issue with politics today. It's so partisan. It's so divisive. I mean, I really believe that Democrats and Republicans can agree to disagree here and there, but they can also get along as well on certain issues too.
I would hope so. Definitely. Yeah. Okay, so I got another viewer question. This is an interesting one, Keith. Your commercials, along with the debates I've seen, portray you as having a calm demeanor, and some folks I've talked to wonder if you will be a charismatic and effective communicator or an uncharismatic, poor communicator like Governor Ige. Do you think you have charisma, Keith? And do you think politicians...
I hope so,
for your sake. And do you think politicians need charisma to be effective communicators? Keith, what do you think?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think I have some charisma. I've been a leader in various sectors of the working world my whole career, whether it's running high school sports or I worked at the University of Hawaii in an administrative level. I worked in the private sector, and I'd like to think I've done pretty well. And so you do need to communicate well and be effective. And certainly charisma doesn't hurt. It helps. And, you know,
yes.
And so, but I'm not, and I think you get, there's different ways to have charisma or effectiveness as a communicator. I'm not a yeller and screamer, as people pointed out, but I still think, you know, everyone has a different personality and a different style. I could never, that's not my nature to yell and scream and whatnot.
Right.
Like you said, I try to be calm and,
and
you know, effective and not yell and be a consensus builder. And I think there's different ways to be an effective leader. But so charisma aside, that's nice to have. It doesn't hurt, as I mentioned. But you have to be a good communicator. I don't care what your personality is.
Right.
And I view that as very important.
Yes.
In any leader, and as mayor, I intend to be, and the public should expect me to be an effective communicator.
That's what we all hope. Yes, of course, of course. And you can tell that not many people like Governor Ige's communication or charisma skills. So just throw that out there. But we have 49 seconds, Keith. I gotta ask you quickly: what were you doing on quarantine? What did you watch on Netflix?
We watched a lot.
What are you doing?
What is that show that everyone watched? It was crazy. Tiger King.
Oh,
is that
boy.
The one?
Yes.
Oh, wow. You know, that was our guilty pleasure that we watched. But we watched, you know, Netflix has some pretty good movies, even Amazon Prime.
NBA, MLB, NFL, they're all trying to return. Do sports, local sports return for 2020? Should it or should it not? Take a pause.
My answer is I hope it does, but we just have to wait and see. This COVID is unprecedented. It changes by the day. It changes by the week. You know, if the spread isn't contained, we're not going to have sports. I hate to say it. You know, and we shouldn't. I mean, because it'll spread the COVID even more, and we'll have to shut down again. So, you know, health and safety, as much as I love sports and I want to see it, everyone's health and safety is a priority. And if not having sports this year will nip COVID in the bud and you know, prevent the further spread and further deaths and serious illness, then we got to do it. We got to bite the bullet as a society you know, not go with sports. If we can contain it somehow, let's have sports. But you know, it's wait and see. I mean, I mentioned, my son's, he's supposed to be a junior in college this fall, and we got an email. All the parents got an email. They said that they want to have a fall semester, have kids move back to the dorms, but they can't tell us for sure, even though school's supposed to start in like 6 weeks, because he's in California and the COVID numbers are getting worse.
Yeah.
So that's the tough part. On the same page,
right,
Aaron, that we want to see sports, but if it's going to be unsafe, then we can't have it. I mean, it's unfortunate. We don't want to be irresponsible.
Exactly. We have bigger things to deal with. We have bigger issues to deal with than sports, which is entertainment, basically. So, yes, totally agree.
Yes.
Any parting words to a lot of people jump back on this despite the whole kickoff. So any final thoughts that you want to give us?
Well, I just want to thank you for the opportunity, and I want to thank people for tuning in, and many of them, I see their names scrolling up. They're supporters and friends of mine, and I want to thank them for their support. And, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm running to bring change. I'm running because I care about Oahu and its future, and I'm running for the younger generations. We owe it to the younger generations to do what we can to build a better Oahu so that they can enjoy the Oahu that I enjoyed when I was growing up and was able to raise a family here. I want them to have the same opportunities. And right now, the status quo ain't getting it done. The current politicians aren't getting it done. And but we need people to participate. You can't throw up your hands or say that it doesn't matter. Your vote does matter.
Yes.
Couple dates, July 9th, voter registration deadline for the primary election. You can vote. You can register on your smartphone. So younger people, no excuse. Takes less than 5 minutes. Just Google Hawaii voter registration. You will get to their website and you can do it in less than 5 minutes. Second big date is July 21. Everyone's going to get a ballot mailed to them. And that's another no excuse. You don't have to go to a polling booth on election day. You can fill it out on your kitchen table or in your living room.
Exactly.
Fill it out, mail it back. It's, again, no excuse. And then August 8th, it has to be your ballot has to be received by August 8th. As soon as you get it, just get it over with and fill out your ballot and turn it back in and do your part. And the younger generation out there, I'm convinced you're going to decide who our next mayor is. Because if you vote like you haven't before, you know, and come out in force, like I think you will, there's a lot of issues affecting younger voters this election in particular. You know, whether it's COVID and the worry about their future in terms of schooling or employment, you know, Black Lives Matter, that movement, climate change, you know, and so much more. This is, or even the presidential election, you know, whichever side you are on, whether you love our president or don't really care for him, you need to make your voice heard and participate in the election. So that's my parting words. Again,
yes, well said,
sir. I appreciate you. Thank you for the opportunity. Okay.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you, and good luck to you. It's coming, going to come by real quick. So thank you very much.
All right.
I will see you soon, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, Keith, I'm here. Thank you.
Take care. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
See you guys. Bye.